friends, good to have you here. I'm Henrik from Sweden. You're listening to Red Ice Radio. If you are a regular listener, you know what we do here. If you don't, if you're new to the program, please check out our website, redicecreations.com, for more radio programs on many of the biggest concerns that we have, and also follow along in our busy news section. We are speaking with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny today to continue the series of shows that we've done on the dangers of vaccines. We are going to cover some vaccine history in the first hour, some really interesting things that, well, at least I didn't know about. Let me just tell you a little bit about her before we begin here. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is an osteopathic medical doctor, board certified in three medical specialties. From 1986 to 98, she was a full-time emergency medicine physician and the director of the emergency department in Findlay, Ohio. In 1996, she opened a center for integrative medicine, now located in Middleburg Heights. Patients have come from nearly all 50 states in the U.S. and 14 countries to get well using a combination of conventional and holistic therapies. Well, thank you for coming on the program, Dr. Tenpenny. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I was looking forward to this a lot.
Thank you so much. It's great to have you here. Well, we have a lot to discuss, and this is always a very important topic. We keep returning to it again and again because there's nothing that is more important, I think, about our health. Everything begins from that point. If we don't have that, then everything else becomes so much more difficult, and we can't fight all those other important battles. But we have a lot to discuss here. But if there's anybody who might not be familiar with your work, I think many are already, but give us just a little bit about your background. Sherry, when you got onto this track, particularly of speaking out against vaccinations the way you do, was there something in particular that nudged you in this direction?
Not particularly. I came from a background of being an osteopathic medical doctor, and most people don't internationally may not realize that being an osteopathic physician in the United States is the same as being a medical doctor. Our training is the same, and actually we get more training because in addition to being trained to do everything from surgery to deliver babies to being working in the emergency department, which is what I did, we also get several years of training in structural medicine, such as the same as being a chiropractor. So we are, I always look at our education as being better than what a medical doctor is, even though internationally osteopaths are really more like massage therapists and maybe herbalists and things in other countries. So in my country, so here I was born into a family of three generations of chiropractors, was not vaccinated as a child, went through the normal measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, pertussis, never really gave much of a thought to it until I went into my career in emergency medicine. I was the director of an emergency department for 12 years, moved to Cleveland in 1996 to open an integrative medicine practice. And while I was here, I got a brochure in the mail from the National Vaccine Information Center in Washington, D.C. They were holding a conference in September of 2000, and it just kept calling to me and calling to me to go to that seminar, and I wasn't exactly sure why, but I decided it was something that perhaps was important. And when I got there, there were about 700 attendees, and I listened for 4 days to medical doctors and research scientists and parents talk about all the problems that had come to them or that they had researched about vaccines. And I thought that was really quite unusual because I never gave it a second thought about vaccinations. And when I was in the emergency department, I obviously gave away vaccines, particularly tetanus shots, like they were some special kind of candy. And never really looked into it. Well, at that point when I came home, I said, maybe there's something here that I need to investigate. So I read to the Center for Disease Control, and I read the first paper, the General Recommendations of Vaccination, and it was the 1998 version of that, and read it and said, how could we possibly be building an entire industry off of this? It's not good science. It's poorly written. It's left you with your head scratching, like, really, this is what we should be doing is vaccinating not only newborns but preemies with hepatitis B vaccines and doing it at the same dose that we would give a 150-pound adult. How could that be right?
Yeah.
So from that point, I said, maybe there's more to it, and I've spent the last 16 years and 20,000-plus hours of my life researching problems associated with vaccines and only pulling information out from the mainstream medical journals because it is there. It's published there. It's nothing that's hidden. It's written in plain sight. And we have created what's called the Vaccine Research Library, which is a website. It's vaccinereserchlibrary.com. It's a membership site, and we have over 7,000 articles pulled from the conventional medical literature that shows conflict of interest, problems of vaccines, damages that they are causing. And we have become very loud in what we've been saying, that vaccines are not safe, they do not protect you, and they definitely do cause harm.
Yeah, because the material that has led you and others to come to this conclusion is not out in the fringes somewhere and something that obviously people have conjured up themselves. This is something that's based on the material that is at the base of the research that has been done already. And that's, I think, something that people don't understand. So maybe you can take us back a bit and let's go over some of the basics and cover the fundamental points of why you are opposed to vaccination. What suggests that it doesn't work? I mean, I think there has been a pushback in the recent year, really, on a level we haven't seen before, because more and more people are becoming aware of the dangers of vaccination. They are choosing not to do this, and therefore we've seen quite a bit of ramped up rhetoric, shall we say, that tried to push these people back and say, you're crazy for not going with the vaccination. But tell us again, Sherry, why have you come to the conclusion you have?
There's two steps to that, Henrik. One is that the vaccine industry is based on a couple of premises that are incorrect. The first premise is that every single person will be exposed to every virus and bacteria out there. And that's, and we, not everyone is exposed. And that's the first false premise. The second one, which is even more egregious, is that if you are exposed, just simply exposed to measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, then of course you are absolutely going to contract that disease and you're going to have the worst case scenario of that disease. And my golly, you just might die. And none of that is true. And then the third thing is, but if you are exposed and to the disease and you are vaccinated, then you absolutely won't get sick. And we know for sure that's not true either, because a lot of times when there have been outbreaks of like the measles, mumps, rubella, measles, mumps, or chickenpox or pertussis, when they do the retrospective reviews and the analysis of the information, they find that most of the people that contracted the illness were fully vaccinated, and many of them with more than one vaccine. That even includes tetanus. I mean, the CDC comes out with a new tetanus report about every 3 to 4 years of the number of cases of tetanus reported in the United States, and anywhere from 16 to 18% of the people that contract tetanus have had four or more tetanus shots, and they have adequate level of what is called protective antibody. So if that's true for tetanus and it doesn't really protect you, how much more is it true for all of these other things that are nothing more than a cough, a fever, a rash, and some diarrhea? And that it's my contention that I would hope that we would, as a society, would come to the point at some point in time and say, I'm more fearful of what's coming through that needle, all the toxicities in that syringe, the potential long-term complications of neurological disease and autoimmune diseases, cancer, even death. I'm more fearful of that injection than I could possibly be of a fever, a cough, a rash, and some diarrhea.
Yeah, exactly. Now, is the basic premise wrong, do you think, in terms of being exposed to some of them to let your body build up immunity towards them? Is there any truth to that, do you think?
There's absolutely truth to that. I mean, when you look back just two generations ago, we looked at these childhood diseases that came at the appropriate ages, usually somewhere between 6 and 9 years of age, as rite of passage diseases. That, it's like, oh yeah, the kid's got chickenpox, or yep, we're going to have a chickenpox party and get everybody in the neighborhood to get chickenpox at the same time and get it over with. And the same thing with measles, and nobody thought much about mumps and this whole thing of saying that, well, if you get mumps, you're going to be sterile, which isn't true. And there's just a litany of one thing after another that once you start pulling back the curtain and going down the rabbit hole, you start seeing more and more fabricated information, it misinterpreted data. There's just nothing about it that is truthful or has any validity.
Now, there's a lot of different types of vaccination. Of course, we can cover some of them a little bit later in more detail. But Obviously, one of the big elements of worry here is the ingredients in the vaccines. And I think, I believe that they've changed somewhat over the years. Things have been added. It feels like it's getting partially worse and worse every year to go. And hopefully those who received it, this might not be true, but hopefully those who received it, 20, 30 years ago, had a little bit less exposure to some of the harmful ingredients they put in it these days. Tell us more about that.
Up through 1985, there were only three vaccines. There was MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella. There was polio, and there was DPT, which diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. So there was MMR, DPT, and polio. That was the only vaccines that were given routinely up through about 1985 here in the United States. They were not forced on people. They were loosely required for school. And there were fewer vaccines. There were fewer doses, and they were spread out, and they were given one at a time and spread out and allowed the body to assimilate a lot of the toxicities in them. Starting in 1991, we had this big ramp up in the schedule. And in 1991 is when we added hepatitis B vaccines at birth, and we added the Hib vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And we saw the autism scale go skyrocketing. And since that time, children now get 49 doses of 16 different vaccines. And inside of all of those 16 different vaccines are a conglomerate of 63 to 65 different types of toxic chemicals. Now, each one of the vaccines individually obviously doesn't have all 63, but if you're getting all the doses of all the vaccines, that's what you're getting injected into your precious little child's 10-pound body. And so those ingredients are things like formaldehyde, which about 3 years ago was officially added to the list of known carcinogens. There is aluminum, which has implications for all sorts of neurological diseases. Mercury is still in the multi-dose flu shots. Polysorbate 80 is a ingredient that's in the DPT vaccines and also in the Gardasil vaccine. And the polysorbate 80 has been shown to cause uterine and ovarian atrophy in female mice. One of the other ingredients in Gardasil is borate or borax, which is like the soap that you put in your dishwasher or in your laundry detergent. And that borax has been shown to cause testicular atrophy and wasting of the testicles in little male mice.
Wow.
So these are really toxic, horrible ingredients with lots of complications that may not be seen immediately, but with multiple doses certainly can have long-term ramifications.
Now, someone told me that why they added aluminum was as a kind of an activator, a reactive agent to start a process or whatnot. I mean, do you know if that's true?
That is, well, it's not really an activator. How it actually works is it acts as an adjuvant, which when you get a vaccination, an injection, let's say, in your arm, with the solution that's in there, it would just quickly be washed into your system and washed away and wouldn't have enough time for your white blood cells to come along and start to make the antibodies, which is the whole intent of the injection in the first place, is to develop an antibody, which we can talk about that in a little bit more in detail later.
Yeah.
But what the adjuvant does, what the aluminum does, is it creates an area of the best way to describe it, it's like creating a little well or a little wall around that solution that's injected that holds it in that place longer so the white blood cells can come by and see the virus, the particles of the viruses and the antigens that are there in order to make the antibody. But what's interesting about that is when you pull some of the very long articles that I have a lot on my computer about aluminum. They have seminars and like 3 and 4 day seminars and workshops at the CDC and at the NIH about these things called adjuvants. And aluminum has been used in the vaccine since at least the 1940s. And when you pull those document parts and read it, they still don't know how it works. They still don't know why they use it. They do know that it causes a problem, but they don't really have anything else that's any better. So we're just going to keep using it.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. What's the reason for formaldehyde? Is it a preservative, or why do they add that?
The formaldehyde is used a lot in the polio vaccines and also in the DPT vaccines, and it's used as an inactivator, and particularly with DPT because those vaccines are toxoids. So you have a tetanus bacteria, Clostridium tetani that grows in dirt, and it rolls up in a little ball, and it remains rather dormant until it becomes active, until it gets into an environment in which it can kind of sprout and grow. And at that point in time, it gives off a tiny little neurotoxin called that's a tetanus toxin, and it's that toxin that actually creates the syndrome or disease for which we call tetanus. So they take that tetanus toxoid, which is extremely, extremely neurotoxic, and they inactivate it with the formaldehyde. And the formaldehyde stays in the solution, not only because they can't extract all of it out, but it also helps to make sure that that tetanus toxoid remains inactive. And the same thing applies to the pertussis fraction. There's several different pertussis fractions that go into the vaccine, and it's there to be an inactivator of the viruses.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, of the toxoid. And then in the polio vaccine, it's there to be an inactivator of the virus.
I see. Well, I mean, aluminum, formaldehyde, all these other things are toxic, folks. You don't want to inject these into yourself or your child, for that matter. Tell us a little bit more, then, about antibodies, the creation of antibodies.
Well, antibodies are there to act as a defender. Now, you have to look at the immune system as a whole. There's two parts of the immune system. There's like two arms, and I kind of conceptually think about them as teeter-totters. And one arm is called Th1, and one arm is called Th2, and they have to act in balance. And when you actually get an infection, like you get the flu or you get measles, what it does is it engages both of those arms of the immune system, the Th1 and the Th2 side. The Th1 is the white blood cells, the macrophages that go and gobble up the invading virus, and as they start to go to war with this virus, they release particles called cytokines that increase the body's temperature. And so you get chills and fever, and that's the indication that there's an invader on board, and the invader can't live at 102 degrees Fahrenheit, but, you know, at 98.6, it sets up shop. So the Th1 side starts to gobble this up and starts to create the fever and starts to fight off this infection. And as the infection starts to go away, then your lymphocytes start to make these antibodies that go and coagulate with the bacteria and the antigen and clump it into place, make a little clump out of it so your immune system can make the infection go away. Well, the antibodies become a marker of that infection so that the next time that that invader comes around, the body says, I recognize that. I'm going to send a few of those little antibodies over there to glob onto it and to make the infection go away. Now, that's what a normal infectious process looks like. You've engaged both sides of the equation. You have body memory. You have immune system memory. And that's what creates long-term immunity once you have actually had measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, things like that. Well, what the antibody is supposed to do from a vaccine is it's supposed to replicate that process. So instead of having to experience the fever and the chills and the things that go along with being sick, we inject the solution into your body to create an antibody. They refer to that as protective antibody, that antibody then should act as a substitution for your body's own real antibodies. The problem is that it really doesn't work that way. I mean, first of all, you haven't engaged both sides of the immune system in order to have full long-term immunity. The second thing is that the antibody that is made from the injection isn't necessarily going to react with the virus or bacteria that's out in the environment because it doesn't have the same antigen attached to it or the same antigenicity of the way it was made. I look at antibodies as being nothing more than a marker of contamination. I mean, we know that we inject something and it created an antibody to whatever it was that we injected, but we can't really say for sure that antibody that we injected, that created from that injection, is going to react with the virus and the bacteria out there in the environment. Hence, when we see things like people that get a flu shot and they get the flu anyways, which happens more than 86% of the time, they get a pertussis vaccine and they still get pertussis. They get the mumps vaccine, they still get the mumps, and on and on.
What do you know about the polio vaccine when this was introduced? Jonas Salk, of course, received all the credit, but he actually developed it with a team of scientists. But when this was introduced in 1963, I heard that polio was largely going out the window, more or less, slowly but surely. And then when the introduction came, it actually started spreading again. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, usually when the conversation about vaccines comes first on the table for the uninformed and the uneducated, it always starts with the place of, well, what about smallpox and what about polio? And we can talk about smallpox in a couple of minutes, but the polio virus is a gastrointestinal virus. It's an enterovirus. And when you actually look at the information that was actually published in the CDC data and published in actually vaccine the big textbook, it actually says that less than 0.02% of people who contracted polio had any long-term paralysis. And in fact, more than 98% of people who come in contact with this enterovirus called polio end up with what looks like a stomach flu. It passes through with some diarrhea, and they end up with a lifetime of immunity. We have indoctrinated people's brains multi-generationally to believe that polio is a synonym for paralysis.
Right.
And it's not. And so when we developed the vaccine was created with a lot of hype because they said, well, it was, you know, had all of this attention of FDR in our country, and subsequently they've now determined that they don't even think that he had polio. But it got the whole bandwagon going. And when we think about polio, we think about iron lung, children with braces, and paralysis, which the actual number of people who had those things, which indeed were real, but the actual numbers were extraordinarily small in proportion to how we blew up this vaccine. The Salk vaccine was actually released in April of 1955, which was on FDR's birthday. And at that point in time, the peak of the number of cases of paralysis that were happening over the summertime had already started to decline. And by the time the Salk vaccine, the oral vaccine came out, the little sugar cube dose came out in 1963, that most of the cases of polio out in community-based polio had already dropped to a negligible level. And of course, the pharmaceutical industry and the government took advantage of that and said, of course, it was the vaccine that made it go away. When indeed what they did was they changed the criteria in the public health records what an epidemic was, what the actual definition of polio was. Because initially it was when you were examined by your family doctor and you had paralysis in one limb or another on two separate occasions within 24 hours, they diagnosed that as being polio. Well, after the vaccine came out, it was that you had to be diagnosed with paralysis in a limb on two separate occasions 2 to 3 weeks apart. And knowing farewell that most people that had this polio, this paralysis, it was very transient and it went away within a couple of weeks, we defined a new disease and we blamed it and we gave credit to the vaccine for changing polio, which in fact it did not.
Hmm. How much do you know about what their incentive for this was? Were they really concerned, do you think, and they just looked the wrong way or tried to find the wrong solution, or was it the beginning of a pharmaceutical conglomerate at that point that wanted to seek and see to it that as many as possible are getting vaccinated?
I think it was probably a combination of things, quite frankly. I think there was a lot of hysteria and hype going on around that time. You know, our president had this paralysis, and they had worked for many, many years to actually even find a solution that the virus would replicate in. Because in order to culture a virus to make a vaccine, a virus has to develop inside of a living tissue. And they used many, many, many different types of tissues that just didn't work. I mean, they tried all kinds of things, and the virus wouldn't grow. Until finally they found these African green monkey tissue that the virus seemed to grow in that. So the research has been going on for many years. I mean, you know, almost 10 years, I believe, maybe even a little longer, to try to find a way to grow the polio virus in a large enough quantities to be able to make a vaccine. I think there was a lot of media hype, just like we see today. I mean, oh my goodness, you know, the measles thing that happened in Disneyland.
Yeah.
And all this stuff. And I think the media hype was probably similar back in the 50s. people were probably even more trusting of Walter Cronkite and what came through their television back in the 50s than what they are today. And parents were terrified of their children going out. I think there was some scientists that had some very legitimate concerns. The problem is that the science was faulty. And even when when Salk's first vaccine came out, there were many researchers that said, this isn't right. His data is based on small batches. We can't ramp this up and ensure safety. There were states all over the union where they had never, ever even seen a case of polio. And as soon as they started with the vaccine, they started seeing paralysis. That was all in the chiropractic literature. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why my parents decided to not vaccinate me as a child, because I was born in 1958. You know, right when all of that hysteria was going on. Mm-hmm. My dad had been fully vaccinated when he was enlisted in the Korean War and got deathly sick. And then when he, as a chiropractor, started seeing all these case reports of paralysis after the vaccine. So he and my mom got together and said, nope, there's no way. We're not doing this to our daughter.
Yeah, well, thank God for that, huh? Somehow, somehow their version of what all of this was about managed to stick for some reason. We can talk more about that later of what this has grown into, the whole vaccine industry, if you will. But tell us a bit more about smallpox before we move on here.
Yeah, well, smallpox, that whole thing about the smallpox vaccine is just, the first smallpox vaccine was in 1799. The first smallpox vaccine in the U.S. was in 1801. I'm sure that at the time that, again, there were raging epidemics and a lot of people died and people were just hoping for an answer. And Jenner came up with this wild harebrained idea that if the nursemaids that got cowpox, as they got pox on their hands where they were milking cows, if we could take that pox and grow it on the cow and then inject it into infants, somehow they would be immune to smallpox. So from the beginning, we used one virus to try to protect against another, and it was a long and lengthy, ugly history from the very beginning of the smallpox vaccine. It was unsanitary. I mean, the actual way that the vaccinations were given were just atrocious. I mean, they put this pus on the belly of the cow, or they extracted pus from the bottom of a horse's hoof. Took a unsterile blade and made a hash marks of 7 to 8 slices and cuts in the arm of the mother. They slathered the cow pus or the horse hoof pus on the arm of the mother. And after 4 to 5 days, when it started to fester and get just all pussy and awful, they scraped it off and injected it into babies and stabbed it into babies. So it was an unsterile, filthy, awful thing from the beginning. Jenner was given the 10,000 British pounds to develop this, which back in, I mean, that'd be a lot of money now, but think of what the equivalent of that was in 1800.
Yeah.
The politics that were involved with it in the UK were very steep. In 1853, it was the first mandatory vaccination was passed in the UK to require people to have the smallpox vaccine. It was very class-based oriented for the trying to inject these horrible things into the poor people, because they said these children were filthy and they were nidusses of disease, and so we had to vaccinate them. I mean, the history is very rich. There are lots of really good books written on it. And I think that if people really understood what was behind this from the beginning, that it was at the beginning when the physicians, there was no real medical care then. There was no medical schools as we know it. In order to become a physician, you could buy a license, you could be an apprentice, you could be an apothecary and work with a druggist first and then just declare yourself as a physician. So there was no education at that time. So medicine, vaccination, and politics, and big money all got woven together at the very beginning of when vaccination started in 1800. And it's grown up together. And I believe it's my opinion why physicians have a hard time analyzing anything that's adverse or is not favorable about vaccination, because it's woven into the DNA of what physicians feel like they need to do for people. And if they start questioning it, they have to start questioning all of it.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, humans get diseases. We end up fighting for our lives in various ways. It's just part of nature. I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to improve our environment or do the things that we have done. We even improved nutrition and hygiene and learning about these things are things that have, you know, contributed to us not dying from some of the diseases we did many, many years ago prior to that. But I think partially it's this idea, too, that we think that we can somehow just develop something magical that just makes it all go away, right? Isn't that what we believe in, that somehow the doctor's going to fix everything for us, and no matter what you do or what choices you make, we're all going to be able to get out of this one, right?
Yeah, and I don't even like to refer to infections as diseases. I mean, we do talk about infectious disease and things like that, but that is a medical subspecialty, but an infection is an invasion of a pathogen, a virus, a bacteria, a protozoa, a parasite. It's an invasion of a pathogen that comes and goes. And for the vast majority of people, your immune system reacts like we talked about a little while ago and cleans it out and becomes stronger in the process because it has exercised all of those microparticles and cytokines and white blood cells and all of these things in order to protect you. So health is, in my opinion, an inside-out phenomenon. It happens from the inside to protect you on the outside. I mean, we are surrounded by bacteria and viruses every day. I mean, we go to the park, we go to the grocery store, put your hands on a shopping cart. I mean, how many millions of people, dirty hands have been on that shopping cart, you know, thing as you push it through the store? If you have animals and you're petting the animals, they've been outside or they've been in the barn. We are surrounded by these viruses and bacteria all day long. And the only ones that we give this big hype to are the ones for which we have a vaccine. And as soon as we have a vaccine, oh, man, those diseases were awful, and measles will kill you, and it was deadly, and look at all the people that died from measles because we have a vaccine for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me just ask you quickly about something else you mentioned, hepatitis B for newborns. For those who don't know, tell us why that's a ridiculous proposition.
Well, it's a ridiculous proposition from many different perspectives. One is that hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease, or it's you see it in gay men that it engage in rectal intercourse, and you see it in people that share needles that are like heroin abusers and things that use IV drugs. And so to think that your newborn baby is going to be an IV-using, drug-abusing homosexual and from the time that they're born, that we need to give them this hepatitis B vaccine to protect them at that moment is just crazy. The other thing is that the hepatitis B vaccine has been shown in the medical literature to be the most neurotoxic vaccine they've developed yet. And so when they give it at birth and damage some of those growing neurons, you'll never know what the full potential of that child is or would be. And in fact, I was at a CDC meeting. This was in 2004, and it was, the name of the meeting was the First Neonatal Vaccination Conference, International Conference. And I thought, now what are they thinking about giving to babies? I should go and sit in on this. And one of the speakers talked about hepatitis B and actually presented the data that said that even a hepatitis B positive mother, that when those babies are born, they are not hepatitis B positive, which means that the virus doesn't cross the placenta. And that when they find, if they don't give the child a vaccine then, and they've done these tests like in Africa, they find that perhaps the child becomes hepatitis B positive at 3 to 4 years of age, which means it's a reinfection, it's not a primary infection. So the entire premise of giving this vaccine to babies, even in mothers that are hepatitis B positive, is faulty. How we came up with deciding to do that in the first place was a paper that was written in 1991 that said that hepatitis B is endemic in about 10% of the population in Southeast Asia has hepatitis B. Therefore, we in the United States need to give this to newborns.
Wow.
I mean, doesn't that just like make your brain go, what?
Yep.
What? And I read that paper several times because I thought, this can't be it. And it actually was. And at that point in time, when I did the research on it, at that point in time in 1991, there were actually 476 cases of hepatitis B reported in children under the age of 14. And when they took this to Congress and said, when Congress asked them, give us the data, show us the science and the research that you can prove that this vaccine is safe for newborn babies. And they said, oh, sorry, we don't have that. We only did the investigations on children that were 5 to 10 years of age.
Yeah, there you go.
But we didn't stop it. And to this day, we're still doing it, and we're damaging children every single day with this.
Yep, and there's many others. We'll talk more about the HPV vaccine later, and we'll get to, the process of the government trying to make this mandatory as well. It's unraveling in California right now. We'll talk about some of that later. But let's just kind of cover some of the other areas here of what some of the other side effects are that we've seen in those that choose to vaccinate. You can be how detailed you want about this, if we need to talk about how this changed over time, or if we should just talk about what some of the common things are that we're seeing, because we're seeing, of course, a rise in autism. A lot of people are connecting this to vaccines. There are many other issues going on as well. Some of the HPV vaccines that have been given to teenage girls, they have actually died afterwards, just a couple of days after. But tell us more about the side effects that we're seeing.
I think that we have the most unhealthy generation of children ever, and everybody knows it. I mean, parents know it, teachers know it. Ask teachers when they say, if you've been a teacher for 35 years, what is the difference? And they say, well, the kids now, everybody's sick, they can't pay attention, they're on multiple medications at 7 years of age, which never happened a generation or two ago. We've got the most unhealthy generation of children, and this whole issue of autism, to me, is just kind of a worst-case scenario. I think vaccine injury, and this has been proven and documented in the medical literature, is a long list of things, starting with allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, insulin-dependent diabetes, a long list of autoimmune diseases, a long list of neurological-type diseases, and autism is on that continuum. And people say, oh, they've proven it isn't, caused by vaccines. Well, actually, it is. There have been adjudicated cases that have shown that vaccine can cause autism. There are closed seal cases in the vaccine court that shows that vaccines can cause autism. And even when you look at the MMR vaccine package insert and read about the measles fraction, it talks about causing encephalopathy. Well, what is encephalopathy? It's brain inflammation to where the brain doesn't work very well. The same with encephalitis. It's like an inflammation of the brain tissue, which is exactly where the autism starts from. And so as long as you say it's encephalopathy or encephalitis, you can say, yeah, that's a side effect. But if you say it's autism, you say, oh, no, it doesn't cause that.
Right.
So go figure, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a play on words. And the whole reason why they shut down this whole thing that vaccines causing autism is because in the United States, where they have the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which a lot of your listeners may not know about, I mean, this came into being in 1986 when Reagan signed the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program into law that says that if you were injured by a vaccine, that you file for a claim. The claim has to be filed through the Federal Court of Claims, which is called the Vaccine Court, that has a special master that's appointed to it, which is an attorney that knows nothing about medicine. And they make the decision of whether or not they believe you that the vaccine that you had caused the serious illness that you have. And so when autism started to really spike up and become such a huge epidemic problem, I mean, we went from 1 in 10,000 now down to like 1 in 500, and I think in some places in the U.S., the rates, particularly among boys, are like 1 in 41. And there was an MIT researcher that came out within the last year that said at the rate we're going, autism is going to be 1 in 2. 50% of all children will be brain injured and autistic from these vaccines. So when the vaccine court saw 5,000 cases coming at it for vaccine injuries with autism associated with vaccines, they said, nope, it doesn't cause autism. We're not going to hear any of those cases. End discussion.
Right.
And that's how it ended.
Yeah. Well, let's speak a bit about what some of the things are that could happen if you don't choose to vaccinate. I mean, I don't know how you view this, but is it like a game of Russian roulette that there are instances where this could have the worst possible outcome, of course, as we've seen with the HPV vaccine? But are there others where you believe that people actually have been saved by them? So there's like a, well, basically, does the risk outweigh the benefit, or is it all bad in your view?
You know, Henrik, after 16 years of researching this and reading what I've read and looking at the science, understanding the biochemistry, having an understanding of how the immune system works, I don't feel there's any benefit from any of it.
Right.
You know, health is an inside-out phenomenon. You cannot get healthier by injecting your body with formaldehyde, aluminum, and cells from aborted fetal tissue, and human albumin that goes in and starts these autoimmune reactions. I mean, to do this under some sort of a guise of being healthy and to protect you and keep you from getting an infection that's in for most people is going to come and go, I just think that at some point in the future of humanity, I don't know, 100 years from now, 500 years from now, they're going to look at this, look back at this point in time with this whole issue of vaccination as being absolutely barbaric. And how did we ever come to the conclusion we should do this to our children? And they're going to look at it the same way that we looked at trepidation, and when they used to, you know, drill holes in people's skulls to let the evil spirits out, and leeches and bloodletting that was thought to be something that was going to be beneficial. I believe in the history of humanity at some point, I would love to think it was going to be in my lifetime, but it's kind of doubtful. But at some point in time in the future, we're going to look at this as such a barbaric act that what we have done to alter human DNA and to damage human physiology under this whole thing of making money, I think it's going to be a horrible blip in the history pages at some point in time in the future.
Well, I hope you're right. Yeah, I do hope you're right. What if, let's do one last on this here before we move along, but what about the tetanus? What if you step on a rusty, they scare us into submission every time something like that happened, or you cut yourself on a rusty blade or something. Is there anything to that it would be good for you to do that?
Well, we talked a little bit about tetanus previously in that the most important thing that you do if you've cut yourself or you've stepped on something and you've punctured your foot, it's a good wound hygiene. You need to core it out, clean it out, wash it out, pour peroxide on it because this is an anaerobic bacteria. It cannot grow in the presence of oxygen. You know, put hydrogen peroxide on it, clean it out as best you can. Standard of care would say that you need a tetanus shot. Now, in my opinion, I think if you've got a very deep, extremely dirty wound that there's no way that you can wash it out in any possible way, then perhaps for standard of care and for peace of mind, people would get a tetanus shot. But people get a tetanus shot when they cut themselves on a broken glass while they're washing dishes.
Right.
It's a soapy, clean environment. And the other thing is that people, when you cut yourself, let it bleed for a few minutes. You are not going to bleed to death. You know, if you lose 1 or 2 cc's of blood, and the whole purpose of a cut when you allow it to bleed is that the blood comes forward through the cut and pushes out some of the debris. The other thing that it does is it brings white blood cells and healing things into that wound to help and protect that wound from getting infected in the first place. But at the first drop of blood, we're grabbing something and wanting to make it stop. And it's just like at the first little whisper of a fever, we want to take a Tylenol or an Advil or something because we can't have that. We've got so many things in this healthcare system so backwards that if we just did what was normal sort of things for our bodies, we'd all be healthier without these external things being injected into them.
Yes, I agree. Now, we're going to take a break in a little bit here. I know you had an upcoming event you wanted to mention and talk about. But before we do, let's just kind of introduce the topic of what is happening right now in California, the mandatory push that is occurring that we're seeing by the government in the U.S. I don't know if it's state or federal. You can unravel this for us. But what is going on there? And where is this debate at this stage? Is it how much has been pushed through?
Well, the... It has a little bit longer history at that. I think we may want to talk about that a little bit later about the Healthy People 2020 agenda. and where this whole thing started from. But in brief, there were 110 bills introduced in 36 states in January of this year, of 2015. It was a blitzkrieg event because of an ostensible outbreak of measles, a small outbreak of measles in Disneyland, which caused this media mass hysteria over nothing. So all of these bills had been previously drafted and sitting in drawers just waiting for the opportune time to bring them forth, because they could not have all been developed, you know, over a weekend. And in the course of that, one of the bills, which was SB 277, Senate Bill 277, came to light in California and wound its way through five committees, I believe, and got passed in the House, passed in the Senate, and then signed by the governor. And what that does is it takes the state of California back to the level of not having any choice over what's going to be injected into your children, that all children must be vaccinated by all current vaccines and any additional vaccine in the pipeline that the government believes they should have. And knowing that there are 141 vaccines currently in the developmental pipeline, that could just be atrocious. And now, and so they, you know, we're getting ready to start school here in this, on a state level, and the kids are going to have to start getting these vaccines. They do have an exemption that parents can file up, if they can file the exemption up through January of 2016, that buys them a little time. For example, if you are in the fifth grade, you have until you start the ninth grade to get fully vaccinated by all these vaccines. And there are, people should, in California, should literally read the bill. It is not a complicated bill. It's about 8 or 9 pages long, and you really need to know what's in there. And because there are, that gives you some wiggle room, because in the process between now and the next couple of years, if you can buy a couple of years of time, I mean, there's lawsuits that are pending, there's a referendum going on, there's a recall effort going on to recall Senator Pan, to get him to no longer be a senator in the state of California for what he has done to the people in California. Nobody listened there. There were hundreds and hundreds of parents who went to Sacramento, took time off of work, dragged their families to Sacramento to be heard, and they were ignored. And this bill was passed anyways. And what is horrifying to me is, imagine that you were a parent and you had 3 children, and your first child was severely vaccine injured, maybe had a seizure disorder, maybe even died. Maybe they even got a compensation awarded for them through the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program because it was so bad. And now that law is going to force you to vaccinate child number 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah, my God. Horrifying. Yeah.
Horrifying. It just gives me, just makes me sick to my stomach to just think about it.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, well, we'll pick this up and speak more about this in the second hour here. Talk about the healthy 2020 agenda. And, of course, we have tons of folks speaking out about vaccinations now as well. We had the whole CDC whistleblower thing and just many things that actually have unraveled right now. And it's really kind of taking place in California right now. So we'll talk more about that. But let's give out some of the websites here, Sherry. I want you to share with us, of course, some of the titles that you have, the books you have available, where people can go to find out more. And then, of course, tell us about the upcoming event that you have got going on there.
Yeah, we'd love to have everybody join me on Facebook. My Facebook page is, you know, you can get it from two perspectives, either Dr. Tenpenny on vaccines, and Tenpenny is just like it sounds. Don't make it complicated. It's Dr. Tenpenny on vaccines, or it's facebook.com/vaccineinfo. I have 157,000 fans, growing by thousands every week now, and most of the people there are that don't vaccinate, or wish, or tell their stories about how they came to not vaccinating their kids. And if you go to that Facebook page now, there's a cruise that I'm going to be speaking on the end of January that goes from Los Angeles to the Mexican Riviera. It's January 24th to the 31st of 2016. And I believe that a lot of people that listen to this podcast would like to listen to the topics. They are topics on GMOs and vaccinations and fracking and geoengineering, 9/11 cover-ups. It's going to be a really fun time. And if you go to my Facebook page and click on my link, then they'll know that I was the one that invited you, and we can all get together in a special way on that cruise. My website for books and DVDs is drtenpenny.com, just drtenpenny, drtenpenny.com. My medical clinic is Tenpenny Integrative Medical Center here in Cleveland, Ohio, and we've had patients from all 50 states and about 17 foreign countries, even people from Europe that have come to our clinic to get well and get off their medications. And then my vaccine research library has all of the data that you need. You can sign up for several MMR, pertussis, and aluminum information all for free. There's newsletters that we send out from there. And then my partner website is edgytruth.com, and we do some significant work together to get the edgy truth out about all kinds of topics.
All right, very good. We'll have some of the websites up, drtenpenny.com, of course, edgytruth.com, and then also we have the – we'll make sure to add links to the vaccine info page and also Sherry's personal Facebook page, so you can click in through there and find more information about the upcoming cruise as well. All right, well, stay tuned for more here. We'll begin the second segment right after a short break. We'll be right back.
Back in the day, they didn't care about the children. They just had more and more. If you lost a few, big what? What's new? What nature had in store? They didn't care if Sally died of flu. Jimmy meningitis from heat turned to. Nobody kicked up a great big fuss if you lost one to pertussis. Well, actually, I don't believe that's true. They felt grief and pain like you. Talking just a few generations ago, they loved the kids, didn't want to let them go. As a father with a brand new baby, want to do what's right, nothing crazy. Try to get him sleeping on his back in the crib, get a car seat and strap him in. Some people on Oprah and the internet can pass opinions and call me the threat. They say vaccines are dangerous, sounds outrageous, but I want it just the same. Should I listen to my doctor, or he's the invective of a playboy bunny and a pet detective? Toxins are bad, except in the case when you like to stick a deadly one in your face. In 55, this fellow Jonas saw cured polio and how the mothers talk. Hallelujah, no more iron lungs. They said to go back to the summer sun. Now 50 years later, new talk and dish, there was a nasty little rumor about the vaccine effects. So fewer kids got it, don't you know, more needles suffering from polio. I have a niece, her name's Mamie, a brave little girl fighting leukemia. She can't get her shots, but her parents pray she'll be safe. Anyway, see, it turns out we're all in a herd, like skinny little cows who use tools and words. We all protect Mimi by the things we do. That's what you call the golden rule. Should we do what's effective? He's the invective of a playboy bunny and a pet detective. Should we do one to others? Listen to hacks to say this diseases may come back. Back in the day, they dearly loved their children and did the best they knew how. What do you think they would choose to do if they knew what we know now? If they could take a peek at our history books, would they follow up the lives we've saved? If they had our tools, would they think we're fools, or would they go ahead and make a change? Would they follow the evidence and show a strong preference for wild tales? They once knew, talk to snake or salesman, rabbits, and talisman, cross their fingers and knock on wood. They listen to the doctors rather than infected from playboy bunnies and pet detectives. If now we're saying this year tail, they'd run it back with looking folks out of town.
Don't miss the second hour, ladies and gentlemen. We have more coming up with Sherry as we proceed and discuss health, naturopathy, and what we can do to take control of our lives and our health. We pick up speaking about the government program called Healthy People 2020. We speak about what is in our future concerning the rise of autism, ADHD, and all these other effects of runaway mandatory vaccinations. What is the likelihood that some kind of pandemic occurs in the future? We get Dr. Tenpenny's take on this. We also ask her about what she would suggest to parents that are uncertain about vaccines and vaccinating their child. We have a member section. That's where you can hear the second hour of this program and all our previous shows as well. RedIceMembers.com is the website where you can go to acquire a membership. Support independent media that expose the side of history that we are never told about. Although the lies regarding our health and the lies in the media about the kind of awakening of our people that would topple the establishment and take the new world order out of circulation. All we ask of you is that you use your brain, think before you believe the lies in the media, and go to independent sources like ours to get the full story. Please sign up, get instant access, and we'll talk to you right after the break. Thank you so much for listening.